Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Olympic Games are filled with pageantry and grace and tradition, but lately the games seem less like this and more like this. Higher, faster, further is becoming just faster, faster, faster. Is the Olympics' push towards extreme sports just making them extremely dangerous? Strap yourself in. This is not the curling preliminaries. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm in for John Hockenberry all this week, and I'm here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. It's Monday, February 15th, President's Day, and The Takeaway, you know, is, to me, Celeste, is the Olympics push for faster, faster, faster to get those younger viewers. Kind of like skateboarding on the street. It's just going to make it more dangerous.
And what's with the media coverage that keeps showing over and over the accident in which this athlete died? And I don't like it. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. In Afghanistan, NATO troops now have most of the city of Marja under control. There are reports a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to the Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind and are fighting in pockets. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Jean McKenzie, correspondent for the Global Post in Kabul. She told us the main problem is that the Taliban scattered bombs throughout the city.
We're hearing up to 70,000 IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, have been laid in and around Marja.
U.S. and Afghan troops are also being held up by sniper fire. In other news, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is moving towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government.
I fear that the rise of influence and power by the Revolutionary Guard poses a very direct threat to everyone.
Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, tells CBS News he agrees.
Secretary of State is right. It's no longer a theocracy. It's a thugocracy run by these guys with clubs and worse.
Later today, Secretary Clinton heads to Saudi Arabia, where she's expected to press for more international pressure to impose sanctions on Iran.
In Haiti, U.S. military is scaling back its aid. About 13,000 troops now remain on or near the island, down from 20,000 2 weeks ago. And at the Winter Olympics, officials lowered the men's start in the luge competition down to the ladies' ramp after Friday's fatal accident on the track. U.S. luger Tony Benshoof, who missed out on medaling, says it could have been different. It would have been a different story, rather, if he'd been allowed to start from the top of the course.
If we were going from the top of the track, it would be a completely different outcome.
For more now, we're joined by Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Jason, there's a turn to more extreme sports. The luge is getting faster. We have board cross, several snowboarders on the course at one time, skiers on the course all at one time. It seems to be getting more dangerous. Have the Olympic organizers acknowledged a reason for this? Are they just trying to attract younger members? What's the cause of all this extreme sports in the games now?
Well, several things are conspiring to make the Winter Olympics more dangerous on a few levels. Olympic officials do acknowledge that they tried to update the schedule for the Winter Games to make them appeal to a broader audience, i.e., younger demographic. But a few other factors that are in play here. One is technology. The technology in almost every sport is allowing these athletes to push the envelope more and more. And the athletes themselves have a much more modern mindset in these things. It's not the Winter Olympics that our father told us about.
All right, Jason Stallman, stay with us. We'll have more on the Olympics in a minute.
And best-selling British author Dick Francis has died at the age of 89. He wrote 42 novels about horse racing after he ended his successful career as a jockey. In the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Wall Street markets closed today for the President's Day holiday. Coming up, the Westminster Dog Show begins in New York today, and we're going to talk about our obsession with our dogs. Is it good for them? Is it good for us? That's later this hour.
And in just a few minutes, we go back to the Olympics. Are Olympic sports getting more dangerous? Too extreme? 8778-MY-TAKE. Post to our website, thetakeaway.org, and that conversation is coming up. Good morning. Todd Zwillick here. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry all this week while he's off. Of course, I'm here with Celeste. You've been watching the Olympic Games?
I watched the ice hockey, the women's victory over the Chinese
team. Oh, yeah, 12-1.
Yeah,
I was surprised China got a goal, actually, to be honest.
But, were you? It was better that they got at least one. But other than that, I'm generally an Olympics highlights watcher.
Just
I watch
the highlights.
Reel.
Now, what about the extreme sports? Not only luge, but like
I'm not
four-man
an extreme.
Skiing.
I'm a mom. I can't watch extreme sports without thinking that someone's going to get hurt.
Well, that's sort of the issue that they're dealing with in Vancouver right now. In British Columbia, Vancouver, of course, the host of the 2010 Games, has pulled out all the stops for this year's Games, and they spent about $100 million to construct newer and bigger and, at this point, faster courses for the world's finest athletes. And faster is sort of the point here. Bigger is not always better. Last week, U.S. Slider Erin Hamlin was asked to share her thoughts about Whistler's new luge track, thought to be one of the fastest in the world.
We all are good enough sliders, and we have the skills to make it down, so we wouldn't be here if we didn't. And it's a lot of fun. You know, the reason we do this sport is to go fast.
But that was before tragedy struck. Since the death of Georgian slider Nordar Kumarakashvili last Friday, the International Olympic Committee took several steps to slow down the course. But that's not the only sport where speed is a double-edged sword. It's dangerous, but also attractive, and part of a decades-long trend towards speedier and more dangerous winter sports. And in fact, it's all about viewers. It has to be. Jason Stallman is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. He joins us. He's back with us from Vancouver. Jason, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Jason, we all have heard about the luge accident. We should jump off there because it seems to be the epitome of faster and more dangerous sports. Even though sliding isn't new, it reached new heights of dangerousness. We've all heard about the Georgian slider who lost his life, unfortunately. But can you update us on like the mechanics, the kinetics of what went wrong, why this athlete unfortunately and tragically lost his life?
Sure. The luge accident really does touch on so many issues that are at play here. You mentioned Vancouver organizers spending $100 million for the facilities. That's $100 million plus alone for the Whistler Sliding Center, where bobsled, luge, and the skeleton competition is being held. And from the day it opened, the athletes and coaches and officials involved have noted how dangerously fast the track was. They expected the sliders and luge specifically to attain speeds of about 140 kilometers an hour. They were about 10 kilometers an hour on average beyond that. And there was a lot of voice of concern over the past couple of years, a lot of crashes on that track. They didn't rein it in, and here's where we stand.
Okay, now the international committees, including the International Luge Federation, was defending the track. Listen to Svein Romstad. He's the Secretary General of the Luge Federation.
This track has been operational for over two years. And I think we've had somewhat about 5,000 plus runs in the track. And if you look upon the overall, for lack of a better word, the crash ratio, it is on par with other tracks.
Now, Jason Stallman of the New York Times, he's saying the crash ratio, for lack of a better term, is right where you'd expect it to be. But that's not what you're seeing.
Well, keep in mind that Canada had some control over who would use the track in training. Canadian sliders had, on average, about 250 runs per athlete before the Olympics at the Whistler Sliding Center. The Georgian athlete who died, I believe, had 25 runs before his fatal accident. So to take the total number and tally the crashes, it seems slightly misleading.
Okay, so luge is a traditional sport, maybe more dangerous because of a more dangerous track possibly this year, but there are some new sports that fit into the extreme category. We got to go through them more quickly because it seems less like traditional Olympics and more like the X Games. You've got certainly snowboarding and snowcross, which is, I think, four or possibly more snowboarders on the course at the same time. They do the same thing in downhill skiing with several skiers on the course. It sounds exciting, but it also seems like a recipe for broken legs.
That's exactly what it is. It sounds exciting. It's to us, it seems like a bunch of young kids out on a ski slope saying, "Hey, snowboarding's pretty cool. We go one at a time. How about we all go at once and see what chaos ensues?"
And that sounds sort of like the point. Exactly what you just described is to get those 17-year-olds who think it's darn cool to start watching the Olympics, I suppose.
Sure, and That's what Olympic officials are faced with. Maybe they have a broader audience at this point, but they've also invited danger to a certain extent. The luge death, it's extremely rare to have an accident of that magnitude on a sliding track, but just in the past couple of years in snowboard cross and skier cross, there have been more fatalities and there have been far more injuries. It gets really ugly in these sports, and the conditions at Cypress Mountain where these are being held for the Vancouver Olympics, they're not very good conditions right now because of the weather and the snow quality. So we were out talking to the skier cross athletes yesterday, and they were forecasting some doom there.
And one of your stories in the Times this morning saying that the conditions might even be dangerous for spectators because the fake snow is too deep for them to walk in. Jason Stallman from the Times, I want to ask you this. There's a huge marketing angle for this, trying, as we mentioned, to get younger audiences to watch the Olympics. But it seems like the Olympics is of two minds. The other big sport that gets all of the airplay in the United States is figure skating, which seems to be marketed mostly towards women. There's a lot of fitness commercials and yogurt commercials during skating. And then you whipsaw to extreme exports, X Factor snowboarding, for lack of a better term. Is the Olympics sort of struggling to find its marketing footing here?
I think just like any other big business, it's doing whatever it can to appeal to as many people as possible. Perhaps this is the first time at the international scene it's having to suffer some of the consequences of that on the danger side.
Some of the consequences. But there have always been, I guess, a lot of the injuries we've always seen in dangerous sports like hockey. And frankly, figure skating is not safe. There's tons of injuries in figure skating. They tend not to be visible.
Right. They're not the violent kind.
Right. So what concerns have you heard from the athletes who are in things like board cross? Now, they're probably in it because they want to compete in this sport and they overcome the fear in order to win a medal. Are there any legitimate fears of injury? Do they think that somehow the way Vancouver is handling their event isn't quite safe for them?
No, we haven't heard any athletes in the board sports complain about that. And you're right, it's going to be rare to find an athlete who will admit to being fearful or worried about the conditions. But there have been some complaints from the athletes in the sliding sports about their access to the Whistler Sliding Center in advance of the Winter Games.
And faster, of course, and without being able to practice, can wind up being dangerous, just as we saw earlier this week. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, thanks for joining us from out west in BC. You can follow our Olympics coverage all this week on The Takeaway.
Hey, you want that to go?
For our first takeout this morning, we're turned to Afghanistan. 15,000 NATO and Afghan troops are in the third day of an assault in the town of Marja in the southern portion of Afghanistan. And we're wondering, what do Afghan civilians think of Operation Mushtarak? That means together in the local Dari language. We were joined earlier this morning by Imal Pasarli, an editor at the BBC's Pashto service, which broadcasts inside Afghanistan. And I asked him about the significance of calling the operation by a non-English name.
It might be significant on paper, but in practice and also for the local people, it doesn't mean anything because normally local people are just calling any operation as operation rather than calling them by name.
So they don't make any distinction between this offensive in Marja than they have from any of the others?
Definitely not. And as far as the Mushtarak bit or the togetherness bit is concerned, when we speak to local people in Marja area of Helmand, they all they're worried about is that whether after the operation there will be foreign and Afghan troops there or they will just leave like before and it will be back to square one.
Are they cynical about calling this the operation together?
No, I mean, as I said, people are not worried about the titles of operations. Ordinary people in Helmand, all they are seeing in the past 8 years are operations after operations, military operation after military operation. And in the past, what happened is that after a week or 2 week operation, a lot of civilian casualties, a lot of other damages, and then the foreign troops with the Afghan troops, they left the area back and the Taliban went back to the area and it went to square one. So this is the more important issue for the local people rather than what the operation might be called.
Amal Pasarli is the editor at the BBC's Pashto service.
All right, now a money takeout from Wall Street. Markets are closed today for the President's Day holiday, but there's still some money news now from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Last week, we discussed the trouble that European economies were facing. Well, it turns out that after a little bit of investigating, that the same shady Wall Street tactics that pushed our economy into the subprime mortgage crisis may have contributed to the economic woes overseas as well. Louise, good morning.
Good morning.
So you had a front page story in the Times yesterday, Sunday. You trace Greece's economic problems back to the 90s and a desire to get into the Eurozone, the European Economic Cooperative. Go from there.
So there were very strict rules for countries to get in. If you remember, there were several shifts of countries getting in. They didn't all enter at once. Because at the root, Europe has economies that are of varying strength. They're not all that strong. Some are stronger than others. Greece was one of the weaker economies. They had to meet the rule that you could not have your deficit larger than 3% of your gross domestic product. And so what Greece did, as well as other countries like Italy, is they worked with Wall Street on these complicated derivatives transactions that allowed them to borrow money, making themselves look better than they were, but the money they borrowed did not show up on their books as a loan. It showed up as a derivative. And so it was kind of a backdoor way to meet these EU rules.
And I might call that a shell game. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, that's a loaded term because this was legal.
Okay.
Everything they did was legal. They used derivatives. They used off-balance sheet vehicles. You know, and certainly it's hard to say that you can blame Wall Street because these Greek government officials and Italian government officials wanted these products. They sought them out. At its root, their economies are weak. They've overspent. But Wall Street certainly enabled this. If they, you know, they didn't force it, but they certainly enabled it. We talked about a Goldman Sachs deal with Greece in 2001 where they were able to hide a lot of the deficit, and Greece continues to pay money into that. It's been transferred to a special purpose vehicle now. Goldman's not involved. But Goldman went back to Greece as recently as this past fall in November and said, oh, you're in trouble again. You know, we can help you with some new financing vehicle that will lend to you pushing your problems off. It's kind of like homeowners who took money out of their house through home equity lines. That's very much what Greece did with these banking deals. They sold a lot of their future revenues, like their lottery revenues, and they did that to raise money now and look better than they really are.
All right, Louise Story of the New York Times. It looks like Wall Street may not have learned its lesson after helping Greece finance its debt.
For our last takeout, let's go to California. The Hollywood sign is covered up with a sheet. The sheet says, Save the Peak. And joining us now is Sam Hodder, who's the California State Director for the Trust for Public Land. Sam, why has your organization covered up the Hollywood sign with a sheet that says, Save the Peak?
So to call attention to a conservation opportunity that is truly once in a lifetime. The Trust for Public Land has been working to conserve natural spaces and improve parks and playgrounds, particularly in urban areas, for 37 years, and we've been doing so in Los Angeles in particular. And in working with the City of Los Angeles, we have secured an opportunity to acquire a really remarkable property. 138-acre Cahuenga Peak property is right in the heart of the city and includes an 1,800-foot peak and a ridgeline that extends three quarters of a mile right in the heart of the city, and it also forms the natural backdrop for the Hollywood sign. Now, that property was first bought by Howard Hughes in the 1940s for his then-girlfriend Ginger Rogers. He wanted to build her a spectacular Hollywood mansion. Well, the relationship ended and the house was never built, but the property stayed in his estate for a couple of generations and was sold finally in 2002 to some developers from Chicago who intended to build four mega mansions along the ridgeline and right behind the Hollywood sign.
And you have the opportunity now to pay $12.5 million to acquire it, Sam Hodder. Sounds like you have $7 million right now, still raising funds in order to pick up that piece of land. Sam Hodder is the California State Director for the Trust for Public Land. You know, it turns out there's more than one way to fight illegal immigration. One way to stop the tide of illegal immigrants is to have a really, really bad recession. Almost 1 million illegals have left the country since 2008, or at least that's how much illegal immigration has dropped in the last year or so. We're going to find out why in just a few minutes. coming up, there are nearly somewhere between 600,000 and a million illegal immigrants fewer today than there were in 2008. Why? Turns out it's for the same reason many of us have been struggling, the recession. We're going to talk about that more in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. The sounds this morning from the Afghan town of Marja.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
U.S. Marine and Afghan units are pressing deeper into the city, with most of the area targeted now under NATO control. Brigadier General Larry Nicholson says the main problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs that the Taliban has hidden throughout the city.
We've been surprised by the amount of IEDs we found. There has been no shortage of IEDs, probably even more than we thought.
And this morning we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to the Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today our message to them is your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
One U.S. soldier has been killed in the fighting so far.
Staying overseas, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had these strong words for Iran this morning.
We see that the government of Iran, the supreme leader, the president, the parliament, is being supplanted and that Iran is moving toward a military dictatorship.
Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government. And at the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak has finally ended. Alexander Bilodeau took home the gold last night in moguls, winning Canada's first ever Olympic gold on its home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stand cheering for them.
So far, the U.S. Leads the medal count with six, followed by Germany and then France. Now let's check on the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Wall Street markets are closed today for the President's Day holidays. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The debate over illegal immigration has long been fueled by the argument that people are here illegally and they're taking jobs from American citizens. But with the economic recession, it turns out even illegal immigrants are having trouble finding work. According to new data, the number of illegal immigrants has dropped by nearly a million since 2008. That is clearly the largest drop since we've been keeping records. We're joined now by Mark Rosenblum. He's a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. Also with us, Victor Manuel Ramos, an immigration reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Florida is actually one of the states that has the largest decline in illegal immigrants. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Mark, how much can we trust these numbers? I mean, illegal immigration it's difficult to count illegal immigrants in the first place. So how do we know it's really on the decline?
Well, I think we want to be a little careful about putting an exact point estimate on how much it's fallen. The DHS report that I think you're...
That's Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. That you're commenting on has the drop going from 11.6 million in 2008 to 10.8 million in 2009, so about 800,000. The Pew Hispanic Center, which is the other, you know, real good reliable source on this, puts the 2008 number a little bit higher, and our analysis of their methodology has the 2009 number at 11.3 million. So there's clearly, you know, the number clearly appears to be a bit lower, but
We know it's dropped by a significant amount.
Yes.
So, Victor, your state, Florida, has seen one of the largest declines. You're in the Orlando area. Have you noticed a decrease in the immigrant population there?
Yeah, I think, the numbers just confirm that trend. We have started noticing some decline as early as 2007 because we had a significant immigrant population that had been growing, had become very visible, confident about its chances of staying here. And in 2007, with the slowdown in construction, which to a large extent started here in Florida and a couple other states, many of them found themselves without jobs and considering their options.
Well, that's exactly what Ana Luisa Trevino says. She's a community organizer with the Farm Worker Association of Florida. Here's what she has to say.
They cannot find a job. They don't have money to pay the rent. They don't have money to put food on the table. So it's very difficult for the community.
So, Mark, is it because of the recession? Have we spoken with illegal immigrants who say that they're having trouble affording their to pay for rent and food and that they can't find work?
I think the recession is definitely the primary factor driving these numbers. The other thing to keep in mind is that there's two different things going on. One is that there's definitely fewer unauthorized immigrants coming to the United States. So we see, you can look at the Mexican data and see that traditional seasonal patterns and when people come and how many people come show that fewer people are initiating new unauthorized immigration to the U.S. There's a second question about whether existing unauthorized immigrants are going home, and there's much less evidence to show that. I mean, you've always had a bit of seasonal back and forth, and what the data seem to show is that there's a lot fewer people coming, but about the same number of people going home.
Victor, I wanted you to listen to this other comment that Ana Luisa Trevino had to say.
You go to the business, you go to the malls, and, you see all these stores closing. There are areas that the houses or trailer parks are empty, like ghost towns.
So this is often something many people don't think about, but illegal immigrants are a driving force in some local economies. And what's more, they send home generally a lot of money to their native countries. Is this causing a problem in Florida?
Yeah, I think it adds to the situation of neighborhoods where people are abandoning their homes and stores that are failing. And you can notice this more in areas that are close to agricultural towns, areas where you had construction workers moving in, where, I've gone there to report on the trend and noticed that the plazas were empty, that, for example, went to a party supply store a couple of years back, and they had not sold any merchandise. You could see all the piñatas and party supplies just there in the store, and the clerk told me, well, I had sold $20 today, so I'm thinking of closing the store. So it has a ripple effect in the surrounding communities, and particularly among businesses that are that cater to those immigrants and are often owned by immigrants who came before them.
So, Mark, this has to have an effect on the debate over illegal immigration in Washington, D.C. And I'm wondering, does this make the push to get, legal residency for some of these immigrants, does it make it a better case for it? Or is it going to be that because illegal immigration is supposedly dropping, does that mean they're not going to address the issue?
Right. Well, you're still talking about a very large unauthorized population of about 11 million. So, the problem remains in place. I think that there will be some advocates for an enforcement-only solution for not doing legalization who will cite these numbers as evidence that enforcement is working and we should, continue to do enforcement and let the problem solve itself that way. But I think, when you look at what we know about the numbers, and especially when you look at what we know about the family structure of unauthorized immigrants, the majority of unauthorized immigrants are in families. They have children. They're married and with children in the U.S., and we really don't see any evidence that those unauthorized immigrants are going home. So I think that the pressure to do a legalization from those communities and from the supporters of comprehensive reform will remain pretty intense.
But if one of the causes of this drop in illegal immigration is the recession, that would argue the fact that once the economy bounces back, we'll see them go right back up to the numbers where they were before.
Right. Unauthorized immigrants are sort of the first fired and the first hired. So, I think that as the economy recovers, we'll expect that those numbers will begin to increase again, and the demand for coming up with real policy solutions that create legal avenues will be back.
Mark Rosenblum is a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, and Victor Manuel Ramos is an immigration reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Coming up, the Westminster's Dog Show starts in New York today. We're going to talk about the obsession with pooches. Is your dog a pampered pooch? Is it healthy for you? Is it healthy for your spouse, your kids? Is it healthy for the dog? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Vancouver, British Columbia. Not enough time in the spotlight, I guess, not only hosting the 2010 Games, of course, but has also come in on top in a global survey of livability. Vancouver, the world's most livable city. That's according to a new survey that's out assessing living conditions in 140 cities around the world. A rating of relative comfort is assigned across five broad categories: stability and healthcare, culture and the environment, education and infrastructure. John Copestake is the editor of this global livability report, which he conducted with The Economist magazine's Economist Intelligence Unit. John, good morning.
Morning.
We're going to get to the winners and the losers, I suppose, in just a second. But those five categories, tell us, how do you calculate livability? What does that really mean?
Well, what we do is we have correspondents in each city, and we score a number of indicators within each category. So, for example, in stability, we will score violent crime, the threat of unrest, factors like that. And these scores are all assigned individual weights, and then we come up with an index based on an overall score out of 100. So 100 is seen as perfect and 0 is seen as intolerable. And Vancouver came up with 98, which is pretty close to the top.
They sure did. So we're talking about the winners, Vancouver at the top. And you go down, it's really Australia, New Zealand, and Canada who've done the best. Vienna, Australia is number 2. I'm going down the list now. Melbourne, Australia, Toronto, Calgary. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Vienna is in Austria.
What did I say?
Australia.
Oh, okay. Quick geography lesson for Todd Zwillick. Vienna, Austria, Melbourne, Australia, Toronto, Calgary, Helsinki, on down the list. The rest in Australia or New Zealand. Auckland rounds out the list. Is there anything common that these cities have at the top? You mentioned one of the categories is healthcare. Now, this has to be apart from whether or not the country has good healthcare. This is like access to a hospital in your neighborhood.
Yeah, we have city-specific and national indicators for healthcare. Generally speaking, they'll be nationally set anyway. So, any given cities in a country will probably perform quite similarly. It's just things like private healthcare, public healthcare. I do have a theory about why Australian and Canadian cities come at the top.
Please.
You notice that cities in countries with relatively low population densities,
yes,
tend to do well. I think that's because they have good communications infrastructure because of the distance between cities. But also the cities aren't overburdened in the same way as larger cities might be. So you'll have less crime, less sort of pressure on infrastructure, for example, transport and congestion. And those things make a city more livable.
Now, talk about congestion and pollution. Give us a sense of the bottom of the list, if you would.
At the bottom of the survey, we have some cities which probably are in the press for the wrong reasons. Places like Harare in Zimbabwe and Dhaka in Bangladesh. But the main problem with these locations is more about stability. Instability tends to mean that other areas like infrastructure tend to fall down as well.
Infrastructure falls down. Pollution a factor. I've been in some of these cities. Unbelievably crowded. Dakar, Senegal, wonderful place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there, to be perfectly frank.
No, I agree.
Just crowded and polluted, really.
Yes. I mean, you find that in a lot of African countries and Asian countries as well, I guess.
All right, John Kobstick, editor of the Livability Survey for the Economist Intelligence Unit, the top 10 most livable cities in the nation and the bottom 10. Well, the crown goes to Vancouver, as though they haven't had enough attention this week. Not only, go for the games, stay for everything else.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley, sitting here with Todd Zwillick, who is sitting in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, and the dogs, they run home. Good morning, sun. We talk about the relationship, the special bond between man and his best friend. Is it healthy? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the Middle East today to gather support for the administration's plan for Iran. Speaking earlier, she said Iran's Revolutionary Guard has become too strong and could supplant the government.
I would like to figure out a way to handle it in as peaceful an approach possible, but we don't want to be engaging while they're building their bomb.
Mrs. Clinton travels to Saudi Arabia today. She wants the Saudi rulers to help persuade the Chinese to take a tougher stand against Iran over its nuclear program.
As we've been talking about all morning, today is the third day of a major military offensive in the city of Marja in Afghanistan. Latest reports say multiple firefights are holding up the U.S. advance in the city. Large numbers of bombs planted by the Taliban are also being cleared. For the latest on this story, we are joined now by Martin Patience, BBC Kabul correspondent. Martin, what are you hearing about the fighting in Marja so far today?
Well, that's right. There have been reports of gun battles, some of which have lasted for several hours in Marja City. That's where US Marines are focusing their operations. And what they're trying to do is to take back that town from Taliban control. But as we understand it, there are some Taliban fighters holed up. They're possibly foreign fighters and they're firing back. And you're right in pointing out that the progress there has been slow. It's a built-up area and there are many booby traps. Now, these booby traps and improvised explosive devices have killed and maimed many foreign forces in the past, and they are a deadly threat. And one commander on the ground said it could take up to 30 days to completely clear the town of insurgents. So certainly there's still a lot of fighting.
I think Martin just left us. That was Martin Patience, BBC Kabul correspondent, talking about the fighting in Marja, U.S. Marines and Afghanistan forces.
Back at home, the oldest death row inmate in the United States has died of natural causes. 94-year-old Viva Leroy Nash had a criminal record dating back to the 1930s. His lawyer, Thomas Phelan, says he should never have gotten the death penalty.
But you must understand, Mr. Nash had a profound mental illness even before senile dementia setting.
And China is offering billions of dollars in infrastructure aid to lure North Korea into nuclear disarmament talks. The South Korean news agency is reporting the $10 billion investment will go into building railroads and harbors in North Korea. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning. The Westminster Dog Show opens up in New York City today, and in honor of that, we are having our own takeaway dog show. You have until 10 a.m. Eastern to post the pictures of your dog. We're going to be voting on Best in Show along with a couple other categories. But, you know, here's an interesting fact. The dog show is the only sporting event. The only sporting event that is older than the dog show is the Kentucky Derby.
Really?
And back in 1877, when the first dog show began, the prize was pearl-handled pistols. But it's not just professional trainers that pamper their pooches. Lots of people claim their dog is spoiled rotten. They're probably right. What is this bond that is between us and our best friends? Why do we love dogs so much? We're joined now by two writers who've thought a lot about this. Michael Schaefer's a journalist and the author of the book One Nation Under Dog. He joins us in Philadelphia. And here with us in New York is Julie Clam. She's author of the forthcoming book, You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Michael, you did years of research on your book, I understand, and I'm wondering, you know, this obsession with dogs, it's not quite so bad in any other nation, and it hasn't been the case in years past. So how have we become so obsessed with our dogs?
Yeah, I spent a couple of years sort of traveling around, like exploring American pet mania and doing a tour of pet-crazed country. And, you know, for most people, they said that the major change had been in the last 20, 30 years. And I think that the change, you really see what's going on if you go to a pet cemetery. They're very old pet cemeteries. We've always loved our pets. But if you look at the gravestones from like the 1890s will say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant, or something like that. And by the time you get into the middle of the 20th century, it'll be, you know, here lies Fido, man's best friend. And the most recent gravestones or the tributes you see online or whatever will say, you know, mommy loves you or daddy's little girl or our little boy, things like that. And there's really been this kind of promotion of the pet from a servant to friend to now family member. And, you know, once you do that, that kind of then you start applying all of your human standards of whether it's about organic food or about getting the best medicine or about hiring a highly trained trainer. You start applying all of those to the way you take care of your pet.
Julie, I have to ask you, you know, what he's talking about, treating dogs like humans, is something that not just Cesar Millan points to, but other veterinarians have pointed to as not being healthy for the dogs. And you've said that sometimes it can be a strain in your relationship with your family. How do we make this more healthy for both humans and dogs?
Well, I'm not the person to ask about that. I do Boston Terrier Rescue, and my home is a revolving doggy door of new friends. And my husband is a little strained by that. He goes to work in the morning and comes home, and there'll be a dog there who wasn't when he left. And he has questions.
It's a little worse than buying shoes, Julie.
It is. He comes in and says, that's not our dog. And I say, no, that's Edgar.
That's now our dog.
He's staying here for a few. And he's fine. He's a great dog. You'll love him. He's housebroken. And then Edgar will go over and pee on Paul's stack of staved New Yorkers. And we all laugh.
Ha, ha, ha.
Oh, we don't all laugh. I laugh.
I bet Paul doesn't
Nobody
laugh.
Laughs.
But Michael, you know, if you go to our website, you'll see the slideshow at thetakeaway.org. People love their dogs, and you'll see some very pampered dogs. Not accepted. My beagle is definitely spoiled rotten. But as you heard me say, veterinarians have been warning us that this is not necessarily the best thing for our dogs. Did you find any insight on how to have maybe a healthier relationship?
You know, I think that we spend a lot of time beating ourselves up for the way we take care of our pets. And a lot of the sort of upgrade in pet care is just a financial decision like any other, and I don't think it hurts the pet. It doesn't hurt the pet to get better food than you used to get. It doesn't hurt the pet to spend more on medical care than you might have spent or to hire a trainer. These things might hurt your wallet and so on, but it's not like, you know, people have a really sort of emotional reaction to that as if, you know, you're by feeding this dog better food, you are somehow not giving money to charity or doing something humane. And I think usually for most people, by feeding their pet better food, they're maybe denying themselves a flat screen TV or something. I think that's the trade-off. There are some places where there's an expectation of kind of human type reactions and emotions on the pet's part, which they're not capable of, and then people will feel disappointed with their experience with the new dog. But I think that is much rarer. And for all that the world of our pets has changed, I think it really says a lot about us, and it doesn't. And it's not really something to beat ourselves up over.
Julie, the obsession with dogs, veterinarians say, mm-hmm. may be leading to more separation anxiety on the cause of dogs. Have you seen this among your own dogs?
I think my dogs have separation anxiety if I walk from the couch to the bathroom. But they are just used to being with me very, very close. My dogs, you know, focus on me and, you know, they're in a constant state of jubilance if I look at them. So, We don't.
Do you give that kind of attention to your husband?
Yeah.
I don't believe you somehow, Julie Clam, author of the forthcoming book, You Had Me at Woof. Michael, do people sometimes let their family relationships suffer a little bit as they're giving all this attention to their dogs?
There's definitely some of that. I think a lot of people have a hard time sort of separating the two. And, you know, I think one of the things that's happened is that people who used to be in categories where they would say, don't get a dog, you know, if you're single, say, or if you're in a two-career couple, which are much more common than they used to be, they are now getting dogs, and there's this whole kind of infrastructure of services to help you take care of that.
Thanks to both of you for joining us. That's Michael Schaefer. He's the author of One Nation Under One Dog. And the Westminster Dog Show is starting today in New York. We're having our own dog show here at The Takeaway, so you have until 10 a.m. Eastern today to send in the photo of your pet. It is very, very soon, so go to thetakeaway.org for directions on how to send yours. And then the judging begins. You're actually the judges, so go to our site, thetakeaway.org, to vote. And we're also taking your comments on what do you think? Are we too obsessed with our pets? And is it healthy for you? Is it healthy for your dog? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
While you're there, you can keep the conversation going on any topic in the news that has you talking. We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning, which has got off to a sad start when a loser died during practice last Friday. But have some sports gotten too dangerous? We're looking for your takeaway. Manuel posts to our site, the IOC is capitulating to children, as so many other institutions have done. 17-year-olds need to be told what to do, not the other way around. We need to consider why youths won't watch athletic competition that's not dangerous just to satisfy their morbid caprice. Well, youths also have a lot more money than they used to. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Post your comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.